morning. You are listening to 2SER, and this is The Third Degree, our Enviro Social Justice Half Hour. I'm Simon Unwin, and you can hardly have failed to notice that we're midway through the first week of the Clean Energy Futures Package, otherwise known as the carbon tax. The partisan debate continues to rage around this policy. The likes of Alan Jones tell us that the carbon tax will destroy Australia, while the likes of GetUp insist that putting a price on carbon emissions will drive clean energy investment. But there are also those on the left who question the wisdom of applying a market mechanism to try to decarbonise the Australian economy. One of those people is Tad Tietze. He's a blogger and political commentator who runs leftflank.org with Elizabeth Humphreys. Tad and Elizabeth have written for ABC's The Drum, and they've also been vocal critics of the carbon tax and emissions trading schemes. This week, Tad and I had a lengthy discussion about carbon trading, neoliberalism, and the left. Tad, we're a couple of days into the brave new world of Australia under the carbon tax, or the Clean Energy Futures Package. Of course, that's going to transition into an emissions trading scheme. And the Labor government have, of course, said that putting a price on carbon emissions is the only way to drive investment in renewables up and drive emissions down. And the whole debate has been quite narrow in scope. What are the problems with this? What are the problems with relying on this kind of market-based mechanism?
I think the choice of a market-based mechanism really reflects an ideology about the economy far more than a deep commitment to actually fixing the emissions problem. Because if you look at the problem of emissions, it's clear that because fossil fuel energy is right at the centre of not just our economy, but the world economy, that you need some pretty major structural change in order to reduce emissions by the, 90 or more percent we need to reduce them across the world, over the next 20 to 50 years. And I think by starting with a market mechanism, you have to say, well, what is it they're really trying to achieve here? And it seems to me that the starting point has been, how do we protect the normal operations of capitalist markets, rather than starting with how do we actually reduce the emissions? So I think that's really, it's really an ideological thing rather than a practical thing. And sometimes people get caught up in the debate about the technicalities of it. And I think that's a mistake for the left to get caught up in that debate about the technicalities of it, because it accepts then the idea that markets are the way to fix these kinds of problems, when there's absolutely no evidence that you can restructure an economy through market forces.
Well, at least through market forces alone. I suppose, when you talk about the left, it's really interesting to observe. And I believe we spoke with Liz about this when she was on the show. But it's really interesting to observe the sort of the change in attitude and position of a lot of groups that we think of as being on the left, such as the Greens and environmental NGOs, who would have condemned something like this not so long ago.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And in our chapter in the book Left Turn, Liz and I actually focused on why would it be that the left would suddenly have this this hole in their thinking about neoliberalism when it came to climate. And we looked at it in terms of two trends, really. One is that that the concern about climate change didn't actually originally really come from the left or the environment movement. It came out of the scientific community that actually noticed, climate scientists and other scientists actually noticed that this was happening, and understandably became quite worried about it and tried to win elite opinion to this. And so once you go to elite opinion, if their main ideology is neoliberalism and market solutions for everything, they're going to try to figure any problem into that kind of ideology. And I think the left has actually not, and the Greens have not really put forward their own alternative economic or, social restructuring plan. They've kind of tailed in behind the elite plans. The second half, which I think has made this worse, is the fact that the environment movement, whereas in Australia it was one of the most powerful environment movements of any rich country, it has become much weaker over time, much more interested in actually being, at the table of power rather than actually delivering. So from the huge environmental protests that extended right up into the 1980s in Australia, a real political force, a real social movement in Australia, it is now dominated by NGOs who are concerned not to upset government too much, who rely on, you know, government funding some of their operations, who rely on a very passive membership, you know, credit card membership, who keep the organisations going, but you've got a really a small elite in these organisations who are used to lobbying business, lobbying, you know, governments and so on. And rather than lead some kind of alternative, they have tried to adapt their message to what the elite discourse is.
It's funny, actually, while you were describing that that change that's happened in the Australian Environment Movement, I was thinking that a lot of the same observations could be made about the trade union movement in Australia in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think the parallel is actually really kind of scary. We just had the ACTU Congress a month or two ago, and the thing was that at this Congress, where the unions are perhaps at their lowest ebb really since the early part of the 20th century in terms of their, you know, their penetration to the population, their coverage of the workforce, certainly strike levels are at an all-time historic low. So in terms of that kind of muscle, it's so weak. You had an ACTU Congress where there was constant celebration of the 1980s, which was particularly that time where trade union leaders saw the big trade-off as, if we get into the corridors of power, we will be able to restrain our members' wages and fix the economy and everything will be great for everyone. But it actually ended up being the undermining of the trade union movement. So the parallels are really kind of strong. The closer they get to the centre of power, the more powerless they become.
And I suppose the response, or the reason that you have groups like GetUp and so on out there sort of running these very, very large campaigns, you know, the sort of the say yes thing, you know, say yes to a price on carbon. And a lot of the time the argument will be, well, this is better than nothing. Now, do you agree with that?
We don't. We've taken a controversial position for some time now, and it's a fringe position because I think you're right, the debate is entirely set in very narrow terms. But I think there's a problem with putting a position this way because really, it's kind of saying that, I mean, some people believe this really is going to go, things will go forward. I actually find it hard to see, given how watered down this package is, how it's actually going to make any kind of dent on emissions, even if it were to work as promised. Like, you look at the Treasury's own projections about this, they're really very, very weak. And now the Greens are already talking, really, this is only the start. We need to do all this other stuff, quite rightly. But I think the problem with seeing it as this kind of necessary first step is that so much energy has been wasted on this first step that really is going to deliver at best this tiny, tiny amount. What it has delivered is an extreme political crisis. It has been the catalyst. I'm not saying it's the cause of the Labor Party's crisis. The Labor Party's crisis is very deep set. But it has been the issue that has catalysed so many of the Labor Party's problems. It was one of the major things that destroyed Kevin Rudd's leadership. It was when he pulled support for emissions trading for action, you know, in early 2010, that his poll ratings, all the pollsters agree, that's when they collapsed the most. And that led to the coup by Gillard's supporters after that, by the Faceless Men. You know, and let's face it, this issue has also led to the collapse of Malcolm Turnbull's leadership in the Liberal Party. And now it is like the totemic issue that is dragging Gillard down. Of course, the problems actually lie much deeper than that, and I'm not trying to say it's just this, but it's really important to understand that all this effort has been put in by the left in order to do something that's actually kind of destroying a left government.
It's been a lightning rod for, you know, that kind of very vocal and popular and quite extreme opposition to, you know, to the ALP government and anything remotely related to action on climate agenda.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think while that's a minority who are really deeply committed to that, actually the defence by the Labor Party and the Greens of this measure has been very weak. And there's a good reason it's weak, because actually there's no evidence base that this kind of method actually works. There's this huge economic reform coming through, and you know, they talk about it like an economic reform, but there's actually no evidence that this kind of thing actually works for climate, which is what people were really worried about in the first place. That's the reason one of the major reasons people voted for Rudd, is he seemed to have a clear agenda on this issue that everyone was worried about. And it's become not about that at all. And, you know, the Greens might say, you know, they're sort of holding the light aloft for something better, but they're actually marginal to this debate. They're mostly seen as the people who dragged Gillard into this absolute disaster.
You're listening to The Third Degree on 2SER. We're speaking to Tad Tietze about carbon trading, neoliberalism and the left. Tad, if we can examine the logic of the market solution, putting a price on carbon a little bit more closely. You know, the logic goes, I suppose, that if you put these price signals on, well, more or less anything, in this case carbon emissions, then that will deter people from consuming as much of that or causing as much of those emissions to be emitted. So from a layperson's point of view, it might seem like a relatively straightforward idea. Why do you think that kind of price signalling, this market-based approach, actually won't work?
Well, I think in the abstract it sounds good. It sounds like the textbook way the economy works, that that demand changes, and in this case the demand for various fossil fuel-based energies will change because the price will go up and people will choose other options. But it actually isn't how economies really work. I'm not saying price signals have no effect in economies. It's clear that taxation, for example, high taxation of cigarettes and alcohol has some effect amongst a range of other measures in order to change those consumption patterns. But here we're talking about something that right at the centre of the entire global economy. You cannot imagine walking out the door every day and not seeing the huge effects of fossil fuel energy around you everywhere. You know, the transport, the heating, the lighting, everything. It's all connected with that. And so for such a big job, actually, there are other things that investors worry about, not just the immediate prices. We see big pharmaceutical companies get massive fines for doing naughty things, but they continue doing what they're doing because the profits are so large. So the amount of invested capital in energy production, in various forms of energy usage, in coal mining and other forms of mining and so on, in transportation systems, are so huge historically that even if you change the price now, you have to change it by so much to make up for the fact they've got all this sunk investment, and not just monetary investment, but connections with supply chains and sales chains and so on. You're actually talking about really, really huge changes in an economy, and to say that just a price signal is going to change investors' minds. In fact, they're more likely to want to spend money to undercut the ability of governments to deliver those price signals, which is why you see a section of the business community absolutely would prefer to have clean energy, and they see this as a real threat. But is their interest in pushing that changed policy through anywhere near as much as the interest of mining companies or energy companies to prevent those changes happening, to slow those changes, to undermine governments that do those things? Actually, they have much more invested in inertia rather than taking things forward. So you do see a section of the business community that Christine Milne was cheering about, 300 companies, major companies supporting, you know, the clean energy finance and so on. But actually, those companies don't have as much weight as the central companies of energy and mining and so on in our economy that are desperately trying to stop this, who lobby politicians, who make sure things get watered down, who got really an extremely good compensation deal out of the government, which also makes you wonder whether or not, after all that compensation, whether they're going to have any interest at all in changing anything rather than just making a quick profit.
Mm.
I want to say one other thing about market-based solutions.
Sure.
I think the other thing is that market-based solutions have been designed kind of as an alliance of, and then we say this in our chapter in Left Turn, an alliance between financiers and environmentalists. So that's what some pro-market, climate market people have said.
An unholy alliance, as it were.
Yeah, well, they think it's holy because they think, well, if you've got the finance companies on side and they're so powerful, things will go well. But actually, you start to see then that the reasons for having these markets change. It becomes, how do you maximise profit? It stops being primarily about about how you address the climate issue, about how you cut emissions. And so everything becomes moulded along the lines of how do we keep the financiers happy? Because really, the environmentalists don't have that much weight in the economy. So the people you hire to design the markets are people who are used to designing, you know, markets for things like collateralized debt obligations, which were very successful profit-making things, but also led to horrific financial consequences. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of logic to it all that keeps pulling in the direction of profit rather than the direction of actually doing something about this. And, you know, I'd say the simple thing is to start with what do we need to do? What's the quickest way to do it?
Rather than sort of working backwards from, how do we preserve things as they are and move slowly in increments towards, some goal in 2050. It's really interesting to look at those historical examples of, you know, the tobacco industry or petrol prices, you know, both of those things where I suppose there's been quite dramatic price rises on both of those, both of those products. At least in the case of cars, you know, it hasn't made a huge dent in the amount that people drive and the amount of petrol that people consume. And so I suppose in the case of tobacco, you haven't just had those price signals, you've also had direct government intervention where they've banned advertising, banned any kind of even packaging now in shops. So there's been that other kind of approach in partnership with those price signals.
I'm a doctor by trade, and one of the things that's really struck me is how people talk about the great successes of price signals in tobacco and alcohol. And there's definitely an effect, but you look at it, all the kind of price signal effects in tobacco, for example, at best account for maybe over a very long period of time, a 30% drop in tobacco sales, and that's alongside all the other measures. You look at what needs to be done with carbon emissions. We're talking about a 80 to 90% worldwide cut in emissions in a very short period of time, only a few decades, and to achieve, like, even with the best application of price signals in a very limited market like tobacco, you've had all these problems and all these things stopping that happening. So people can talk about what a great success it was, but compared to the task at hand, it is to get caught up with this is to get distracted from really what is the main game, which is how do we rapidly cut these emissions? Is there a way of doing it? And recognising how disruptive it's going to be, so how do you best minimise that disruption?
That's right. I mean, that's another effect of doing something like this policy where you're putting a price on something that everybody uses all the time. And you know, obviously, a lot of those price increases are going to be passed on to consumers, and we're already seeing a bit of that happening. You know, in Sydney, we have the populist Daily Telegraph going on at length about the cost of electricity and price of living concerns. And given that this is something that, I guess, historically has been kind of a concern of the left, I mean, to what extent should the left take up these concerns?
I think at a certain level that there's a lot of hysteria from the right wing about how bad the price rises will be immediately. I think the government has tried to create a compensation package that at least in the short term will buffer most people from the price rises. So I think there is a certain amount of overheated rhetoric that's around about that. But the the tax academic John Passant has done some investigation of how the plan works out over time, and it's clear that with things like bracket creep and so on, that actually the compensation becomes less and less for ordinary people over time. So there is a longer-term plan to shift more and more of the weight onto the general population. And so I think that is a real concern. And I think it is a problem when the left says that after 30 years of neoliberal policies where there's been greater and greater inequality, where in the 1980s and early 90s there were real cuts in wages for the vast majority of workers whilst profits skyrocketed, for people to say, well, this is the next great economic reform and people have to sacrifice. Like, how many more years of sacrifice are governments going to be asking for? And I think that more lies at the heart of why this can be such an easily utilised issue by the right, the populist right, because people have been hurt by this. They see a more unequal society. Here they see this massive compensation package for big business, and what's in it for them? They start to get worried, well, there's other compensation packages that haven't worked too well for us ordinary folk. So I think then it becomes really a political question. And I think it's been more than just a disaster in terms of climate action, because I think it's delayed climate action. It's been a political disaster for the left to hitch itself to this, with honourable exceptions. Radical leftist groups like Friends of the Earth have been absolutely exemplary in their opposition to this, but it really, the opposition is fringe. That's why you see so little written about it. I mean, Beyond Zero Emissions, some of their people are very clear on this, but it's really a fringe activity to be opposed to market mechanisms on the left when it comes to this.
Look, yeah, even in the 2SER newsroom, my third degree colleagues and I have been involved in, you know, some fairly long-winded and in some cases almost heated debates with some of our colleagues. And, you know, being community radio, this is a lot of the people who work on talk shows here consider themselves to be on the left, and we've found ourselves very much in the minority for opposing carbon trading scheme from the left. But how do you think the debate can be opened up, or can we bring the fringe to this discussion and to make things like massive investment in public transport or more direct government investment in renewable energy or you know, things along these lines? How do we make these more possible? How do we make these things that people can consider as realistic ideas?
I think one of the more controversial things that Liz and I say in our chapter in Left Turn really is that we don't think you can just build a standalone climate movement to win these demands. We actually think that's one of the problems. If people think you can build this kind of, we're just going to fight around climate and we'll win the majority to this, it isn't starting from the right place. We argue that this has to be part of a broader movement for deep social change and really something that challenges capitalism more generally. And if you look around the world, Australia's been a bit lucky because there hasn't been a deep recession here yet since the global economic crisis hit. But in almost every other Western country, probably, you know, places like Germany and parts of Scandinavia might be a bit of an exception, there is a deep political crisis that has come out of the economic crisis, and the re-emergence of real movements that start to pose questions about a different current society. You look at Greece in particular, where there has been real ferment about what kind of society do we want, one where there's austerity and the logic of capital wins out all the time and the logic of markets, or is it going to be a society, or are we going to have a society that we're going to base on quite different principles, you know, of human freedom, of real democracy and so on. And in those movements, people talk about those things. You look at the Indignados movement in Spain, huge ideological debates amongst many thousands of people about what sort of society do we want. Same thing in the protests in Greece, the Occupy movement in the United States. I think 2011 was in some ways our generation's version of 1968, where there are these radical movements that start to spring up. And 2012, there's no indication it's going away. And I think it's from within those movements that you can start to pose those questions. And we quote an article by Naomi Klein, who's writing a book on climate change. I think it's about to come out, who argues really, really the same thing, that you can't envisage this kind of real action on climate from governments until you have movements that can pose these kinds of big questions, not just on climate, but about exactly what kind of society we want. And I think that's the kind of period that we're entering into, a period where real anti-capitalist ideas are going to get very wide purchase. And I think there's an audience for them. I think a lot of these people who hate the carbon tax, ordinary working people, are actually very open to ideas about a different kind of society and are not totally closed to the idea that climate change is a problem. I think what's given climate change as a problem a bad name is the politics of things like emissions trading schemes. That's the easiest way to make people sceptical about climate change is to say, yes, but the only solution is another market mechanism.
Yeah, an immensely technical one at that.
Yeah, well, it has to be, because the technocrats have to keep secret how it really works. Like ordinary folk, mere mortals, can't really be allowed to understand it. And there's a very big technocratic kind of edge to politics in the neoliberal world, I think, which says really governments just solve these complex technical issues that you ordinary people, really, you shouldn't even think about them because we need to solve them for you. Mm. But I think people are onto it. You look at the recent essential polling data on people's attitudes to the neoliberal reforms of the 80s, something like 10 times as many liberal voters think those reforms mainly benefited big business and not working people as liberal voters who don't. So I'm saying, like, amongst liberal voters, most liberal voters think that, that those reforms benefited only the top end of town. So there's a huge audience, all voting groups, for a rejection of those reforms and an understanding that there's been a class war going on as part of neoliberalism, and a real distrust of politicians and a real contempt for politicians and technocrats.
Yeah, no, I read that polling as well, and it's fascinating that there is that underneath all of the kind of the media cycle that reduces a lot of our public conversation to sort of gibberish, essentially, there is that fairly deep-seated awareness that there's been these quite large changes happening over a period of, you know, 30 to 40 years.
Yeah.
That have meant massive wealth redistribution upward. You're listening to The Third Degree on 2SER, and that was Dr. Tad Tietze of Left Flank in discussion with me this week. You can read more of Tad's political commentary at left-flank.org. That's all from us this week. The Daily is up next on 2SER. Thank you.